The Science Inside Podcast. This is The Science Inside.
Good evening and welcome back to the very first installation of the Science Inside Show for 2019. And I am your host, Bridget Lebere.
And I'm Lebogang Madisha.
And I'm sure you can tell that this is a brand spanking new year. And as you can tell, we have new presenters, me being in question. And we have a couple of new things on the show and as well as new stories around the world of science, tech and innovation.
Exciting indeed, and today happens to be the show where we have our host science. We host a feature scientist who is doing amazing work in science research.
And yes, very well indeed. We will be speaking to Mpho Chisapungo. She currently heads the South African National Space Agency's Space Weather Center as a space weather practitioner. And the Space Weather Center provides an important service of monitoring the sun and its activities by providing important information on space weather forecasts, giving us warnings and alerts and environmental data on space weather conditions and how they actually impact the Earth.
But before we get into all of that, let's look at what we have in store today. In our news, we learn about the new discoveries of the Mars rover and also a follow-up on a story that we covered on our last show about a Chinese researcher who had announced that he had made his first genetically modified babies. That's all on the show, and please enjoy for today. Yeah. And in our On Science Today, we'll find out about disgusting things, but something which may save mankind in the long run someday. And this is protein made from feces. And yes, you did hear this right. It is feces that we're talking about.
But before we go into all of the nitty-gritties of the show today, right? We have just a bit of a twist, right? Because we usually do the news between ourselves. So today we have Masibulele Lunika, who will be reading the news for us today. So what do we have in store?
News making headlines. NASA Curiosity rover makes unexpected discovery on Mars Mountain. Students present data science projects that address service delivery problems. And as you heard, the CRISPR baby scientist has been fired by his university over the gene editing experiment. Good evening. I'm Masibulele Lunika with the Science News Inside. This week's Science Headline. NASA's Curiosity rover makes unexpected discovery on Mars Mountain. For more than 4 years now, NASA's Curiosity rover has been exploring Mount Sharp, located within an ancient meteor impact crater known as Gale, and rising more than 3 miles high. Now, measurements of tiny changes in gravity recorded by the rover as it climbed in elevation could help solve the question of how the mountain formed. In a new science paper, NASA researchers have detailed how they repurposed sensors used to drive the Curiosity rover and turn them into gravimeters, which measure changes in gravitational pull that enabled them to measure the subtle tug from rock layers on Lower Mount Sharp, which rises 3 miles, 5 kilometers from the base of Gale Crater, and which Curiosity has been climbing since 2014. The results, it turns out, the density of those rock layers is much lower than expected. And we look at our second story. Students present data science projects that address service delivery problems. Students who are part of the annual Data Science for Impact and Decision Enhancement, DSIDE, program, which is funded by the Department of Science and Technology, have developed a new dashboard that could provide a solution to the government's service delivery challenges. The dashboard aims to assist with identifying challenges and establishing an early warning system for issues such as service delivery complaints, budget appropriations and expenditures, a 30-day payment and vacancy rates. According to the department, this program aims to solve real-life problems using multiple technical disciplines, including computer science, analytics, maths, modeling and analytics. The idea is to enable government, especially the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, DPME, which has been tasked to with carrying out this analysis, to tackle issues before they escalate into larger problems that could trigger service delivery protests. The students are part of an annual data science for impact and decision enhancement program funded, as mentioned by the Department of Science and Technology. And we look at our third story, the one that we covered last year about a Chinese researcher who has been found guilty by the government of China. His name is He Jiankui. I hope I pronounced that right. The scientist announced last year that he had produced the world's first gene editing babies, broke international national regulations in his controversial work. Consequently, Jiankui has been fired by his university, the Southern University of Science and Technology in Shenzhen, China. As reported by Scientific America, this decision announced on 21 January by the Southern University of Science and Technology in Shenzhen, China, follows a report of findings from an investigation into his work by provincial health authorities. A probe by the Guangdong Health Ministry found that he broke national regulations against using gene editing for reproductive purposes. Chinese state media agency Xianghua reported this on the 21st of January. Recapping your top stories for this hour, He Jiankui, who announced last year that he had produced the world's first gene-edited babies, was found to have broken national regulations in his controversial work. And pioneering a new milestone in Mars, scientists have discovered a way to measure mountains in the planet.
Now, Masi, we've covered the story last year, and much of our discussion was around the ethics behind the story, which is normal, considering that a lot of these scientific experiments do sometimes compromise human life or don't take it as seriously as they should. It's not really shocking to hear the story, as many have already had their concerns about this experiment. I mean, we are talking about people's lives after all, right?
Yeah. So I'd like to hear... So it's funny. I mean, you said that because and it's precisely why we thought the story needed more debate, because ethics and science are a big concern, it seems. Because speaking of which, an article by The Economist I just published recently last week covers what they call ethics dumping. And according to them, ethics dumping is the carrying out of researchers from a country, usually rich. I'm reading this definition right. Ethics dumping is the carrying out by researchers from one country, usually rich, and strict regulations in another country, usually less well off, and with relaxer laws, of an experiment that would not be permitted at home, or of one that might be permitted, but in a way that would be frowned on. The most worrisome cases involve medical researchers in which health and possibly lives are at stake.
Wow. So we can all agree, everybody in this room can agree, that science is very important, but I don't think it is to the detriment of the people who it's done onto. And the case being in point, when we talk about this issue, there is also a video on YouTube by a channel called Top Fives about the five most disturbing and most unethical human experiments that have been carried out on actual people. And it's quite shocking to hear that stories like this do actually continue, and we need to hold the people who carry such things out to account.
Definitely. People need to take responsibility for such actions.
Sure.
Wow. This is really amazing. I'd love to hear more from our listeners, what they think about these topics. The ethics behind science. Science is a crucial part of our lives, and many times, you know, the strict regulations are a barrier to a lot of research that is being done. So when you get to the question of it affecting human beings and actual lives, then we get to question it a bit more. So our second story, we were looking at the story of Mars and scientists having discovered that the rover that has been called the Curiosity rover that has been roaming Mars for the past since 2014 has discovered, as they have actually used it to actually determine the size of the mountains there.
Yes, and that's actually positive news, because now it helps the human race, and they've taken it a step forward so that we can know about Mars and the scientific world and what's going on around there.
This discovery that's been done by these scientists actually means that the human race, you know, has taken one more step to knowing more about Mars. And as we all know, the planet, which is approximately 54.6 million kilometers from Earth, is its primary objective when it was being explored was to find if it could actually support life and whether humans can ever live there. And you know, in the case of our planet becomes inhabitable due to a number of reasons. So using some creative analysis methods, these guys can now tell us the size of the mountains, and that is quite amazing.
Indeed it is. And according to Mars One after the Earth, Mars is the most habitable planet in our solar system due to several reasons, actually. I'll just name a couple of them. And its soil, it contains water that we can extract. It's not too hot or cold up there in Mars. And there's enough sunlight to use solar panels. And the gravity on Mars is actually 38% that of our Earth. So this is believed to be sufficient to allow the human body to develop and adapt to it sufficiently. And this is good, because a lot of the time space exploration brings up the question as to how we would morph according to the gravity that exists outside of our Earth. And the atmosphere on Mars offers protection from cosmic and sun radiation. The day-night rhythm is very similar to ours on Earth, so that wouldn't change our sleeping patterns much. We wouldn't become zombies overnight. A Mars day is approximately 24 hours and 39 minutes and 35 seconds.
Yeah, so I think we should call Mars Earth 2.
Yeah, maybe you should.
Well, I wouldn't really put it that way, because I think, you know, we were put on this earth for a specific reason.
True.
And the person or whatever entity that placed us on this earth knew why we were actually placed here, because I mean, we ruin our own planet Earth just so that we can run off to some distant planet that we don't really know much about. Scientists say we know much about it, but nobody has ever really lived there, and we still don't know really what is out there. Okay.
That's true. We don't know what space has to offer.
I guess the real core of science is discovering the unknown. So changing the laws of nature is part of
You're playing around, putting some strings in nature, you know, trying to see how far we can go. I mean, look how far we've come
evolving.
Yeah.
Discovering and inventing new things.
But I'm still not excited about moving all the way to Mars.
I mean, I can just imagine how much it would cost, though. Like, one ticket
to Mars.
You'd have to pick which family member is more important. Like, you don't generate much income. You're not going there.
Yeah.
Gotta leave us broke out here.
And yes, and that is the point. I mean, we have to really look after the resources that we have, take care of the planet Earth that we've been placed on. I mean,
instead of seeking new planets,
and we
haven't done anything to us.
Actually, we're just throwing rubbish everywhere. We are polluting the air. I mean, we are the only species on this Earth that really
keep on destroying it. Yeah, that is true.
Mm-hmm. And well, later in the show, we will find out about other things, but you didn't give us your sources for the news.
Yes, we got our sources for this week's news from Scientific America, a very reliable and reputable news organization, and The Economist, which also is quite reliable. They have some really interesting stories.
Okay,
NASA also shared some interesting details about the rover, the Curiosity rover, as well as the Citizen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That was all from the Science News Desk. And then you can catch us next week for the riveting news from the world of science. And next up, we find out from our feature scientist, Mpho Chisapungo, after the break.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Welcome back to The Science Inside. And as I had said before the break, we are speaking to a scientist from SANSA, Mpho Chisapungo, from the Space Weather Center. And Mpho is responsible for coordinating and managing the Space Weather Center, as well as ensuring that space weather services reaches its stakeholders, such as those who are in the communication and navigation sectors. For an example, those who are in the defense and aeronautics industries.
She's accomplished a lot, and she has completed her Bachelor's of Science degree in Mathematics and Physics at the University of Venda in 2006. The following year, she proceeded to do her honors at UCT, and now she is currently working part-time towards obtaining her PhD. Hi, Mpho, and a very warm welcome to The Science Inside.
Hello, thank you, and welcome.
So, I just have a question here. Now, the Space Operations Division at SANSA is relatively new as compared to other projects in SANSA. Why has there been a need to look at space weather?
The Space Weather Center in Hermanus, we actually started doing the Space Weather Center or Space Weather Monitoring in 2010. And other divisions have been there existing. And we actually became part of the South African National Space Agency in 2011. And the reason why we monitor the space weather conditions is because it has impact on our technological systems.
I understand. So how your systems function are directly affected by the weather in space, well, the space weather.
Yes. What happens is that the main driver for space weather is what is happening on the sun. So on the sun, we observe things like we observe solar storms like solar flares and coronal mass ejection. And it's those particles which we observe from the sun which propagate towards the Earth, and then they can interfere with the signals that we are using for satellite communication, for example. So that's why it affects our technological systems in a way that we are so dependent on satellite communication and navigation. And those signals, they get attenuated up in space because of these energetic particles from the sun.
Truly interesting. Mpho, it's Bridget here. And I read that your division is also responsible for providing this very important information on continental scale, meaning in Africa. Can you talk to us about what does this work mean for South Africa and for SANSA as an organization?
The SANSA or the space weather center, we have just received a designation. We have been appointed to be a regional warning center to provide space weather to the aviation community. And what it means is that we will need to provide the, just like the normal weather report which goes on the flight plan, we will also need to provide the space weather information to go also on the flight plan for the whole region.
So now, the latest paper that you worked on was how neural network and linear regression techniques were used to measure the F region of the Earth during geomagnetic storms. What were the findings from this research?
The main purpose for this research, I was trying to find a technique or a model that will be able to detect if there is a storm, if we are affected in a negative way or a positive way. We have what we call the positive ionospheric storm and the negative ionospheric storm. It means that if we have predicted, for example, to use a frequency of 10 megahertz today, and then because of a space weather storm, then we have a depleted frequency. That means you will be able to only use frequencies which are less than 8 megahertz, that we call a negative ionospheric storm. It means the frequencies have been depleted compared to what we have predicted. This model, what we found out is that, the findings from this research is that this technique, the neural network and linear regression, they were able to capture the ionospheric storm response during the geomagnetic storm.
Wow. That seems like really intense work, Mpo. I wish I could say that right now I really grasp everything that you're saying, because there's also so many technical terms that you're using there. But I also understand that you and other people had to travel all the way to Australia to actually learn about this specialized field of study. So I would like to know, what kind of challenges have you experienced or have you seen in this field?
Okay. Actually, when I started, that was in 2010 after my master's, I was offered an opportunity as in a contract position to be a space weather assistant. And by that time, I knew little about what space weather forecasting is all about. And there was one expert in the group, and they saw a need to send me to Australia to do the training on space weather forecasting and prediction, especially when we're forecasting on high-frequency communication, because that has been one of our main forecasts in the Space Weather Center. So the challenge was that it was difficult, because it was like a group of only two people, two of us at that time, and I was still learning, and to be able to have that confidence of sending the information to clients was one of the challenges.
Oh, I really understand. And are the professors also who teach this kind of science, are they few in South Africa? Is there a shortage of them?
Actually, in South Africa, we don't have a space weather course per se. If you want to know about space weather, the only place is in Hermanus.
Okay.
the most of the expertise that we get for space weather monitoring we get them from outside the country, internationally actually, because even the whole of the African region, they do space science research like we are doing, but to do space weather forecasting is something that we don't have.
I'm really glad, because it seems like soon we'll have our own experts, people like you, that we can go to in case maybe I might decide to just leave my radio career and head into space weather science. Yes.
That's the plan.
Definitely an expert that we need to keep close contact with right there. But now, tell us, in terms of the weather pattern changes that we are experiencing right now, what is the extent to which space weather has affected what happens on Earth, according to your research?
What we have observed in the past, for the space weather, they say we have roughly about 11-year solar cycle. So the sun goes to times which is very quiet sun, and then there will be times which the sun is very active. And we have been seeing these cycles going up and down for the past 400 years. And then the past, for the few past cycles, it's like the activity on the sun is actually reducing. We are not seeing that much of the activity, like the last cycle was a bit weaker than the previous cycle.
The one that has been observed over the past 400 years, that is.
Yes, that's the sun cycle. Oh. But the most important thing is that the sun has been active, but the technology that we have been using for 100 years back, it was not so. We were not so dependent on technology like now. Now it's like everything is on satellite communication, navigation. It's like internet. Everything is using satellite communication, and the signals that we are receiving from space is passing through these conditions which are not so favorable, and then it might either attenuate the signal or have a signal delay or signal absorption. Sometimes you may find an error if you are doing your GPS navigation, for example, on your phone, and then your GPS tells you to actually turn right now to your left or your right, but you know that you still have to go further 50 meters to turn to your destination, but just because you know that area, then you just ignore the little person who's talking on your GPS phone. But if the 50-meter error is big enough, if you are using that navigation information for landing, there is a high chance that the plane can crash if you have you think you are already on the ground, but you are still a bit 50 meters up. You see, it's quite a big error.
Yeah, it can cause a huge, huge error. And this is all because of the activity that is observed on the sun.
Yes, it's activity happening on the sun.
Very interesting, I have to say. And also, SANSA has about 20 aerials that monitor space weather. But what other kind of instrumentation? I mean, you're talking to us. We haven't been to your lab. Just give us, an overview of your workspace and the kind of things that you use to come to these deductions about what is happening around us.
For us to be able to monitor space weather, we need the satellite data. Most of the space weather data from satellites, we obtain them from the US Space Agency and the ESA Space Agency. So we use satellite data like to monitor what is happening on the sun, to get those images of the sun and look at them, and then to look at the space environment between the sun and then very close to us. But now the impact on the ground, we have the ground-based instrumentation like GPS receivers, for example. We can use that data, and we have enough of GPS receivers around the country. And then we also have what we call the ionosphere, which measure the ionospheric properties, the one which is responsible for reflecting the radio wave signal up. And then we also have what we call the magnetometers. It's measuring the Earth's magnetic field, and then we can be able to see how disturbed the Earth's magnetic field is. The reason why we have this ground-based instrument is because the impact of space weather, we have a regional impact. So the impact here in South Africa may be different from the impact or in UK, for example, or in the US or in Australia. But the event which we are looking at is the same event on the sun, but the impact, the significance of the impact differs regionally. That's why we need this regional, with this instrumentation, ground-based instrumentation, so that we can monitor how impacted we are on the ground.
Oh, all right. I think I've learned a couple of things from chatting to Mpo about this. But stay listening. Up next, we have Unscience. But before we go into Unscience, we just take a little bit of a breather.
This is the Science Inside.
Welcome back, and it's that time of the show where we go into Unscience. And on Unscience, we look at the stranger side of research, right? Sometimes it's weird, sometimes it's disgusting, and sometimes it's really wonderful. And we learn a lot about what scientists are spending their money and their time and effort on. And today's Unscience was produced by Masibulele Lunika, and the sound clips are from YouTube. Let's get into it, Masibulele.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
I think my mic had a bit of a problem there. Yes, Unscience. I think we can all agree on a few things generally, and some things need a little bit of mind opening to really see the other side of. But I think some of these researchers, before they shock you, are one of those. We can all agree that all things that have to do with poop and pee kind of freak us out, and that we would never eat it, right? Like, you don't ever think of poop in that way, or pee for that matter. Well, it seems like we don't all think the same. You can soon head to Japan or somewhere around that side and get yourself a flame grilled poop steak. Yep. So according to the Daily Mail, Mitsui Ikeda, a researcher from Okayama Laboratory, came up with the novel approach to the ones after Tokyo sewage, asked him to come up with a way of using the city's waste. The researchers in Japan recently brought the stomach-turning offering to the table by transforming human feces into steak. The request of Tokyo sewage scientists investigated practical uses for excess sewage and discovered that they could isolate proteins from the bacteria in human waste combined with carbohydrates and fats, and the results could be served as a meat-like substance. The meat is made from 63% proteins, 25% carbohydrates, 3% lipids, and 9% minerals, according to Digital Trends. Soy protein is added to the mix to increase the flavor, and food coloring is used to make the product appear red. Experts say while it should be possible to make something edible and safe to eat using this method, cooking the steak before consuming it is still strongly recommended.
Do me a favor, please. Get out of here. Get out of here.
I mean, of course, eating or drinking poo or pee doesn't sound appealing to anyone. But with human populations on the rise in many countries, access to clean water and sanitation is a growing challenge worldwide. Now, processing systems such as this one could provide an efficient solution to both problems. And this is according to Bill Gates, whose foundation is funding the development of the technology. So if you don't want to eat steak made from poop, I mean, you could consider having a nice glass of water that was poop once upon a time, right? Not that exciting, but I mean, you could think about it if you're dying or something dramatic happens in your life. In an innovating processing system called Omni Processor, which heats sewage sludge and separates the liquids as water vapor that is then treated to make it suitable for drinking. And that's not all. Now, imagine a poop sausage. I mean, a poop steak wasn't enough. They had to scale it down for you just to get you started with it, you know? Give you a little poop sausage.
Yeah.
This next research, according to The Independent, was published by the journal Meat Science. In the research, scientists have figured out how to use bacteria from baby poop to make sausages that are both delicious and healthy. Now, most people would get grossed out at this. I was at first, but now I'm kind of getting accustomed to it, you know? If you think about it, microbes are already being harnessed to produce delicacies like cheese, wine, and beer, and fermented sausages. And baby poop is actually pretty full of these kind of microbes. Now, using cultured poop from babies' diapers, researchers made a type of Spanish fermented pork sausage called fuet. I hope I'm saying it right to all the Spanish speakers out there. And they claim that it tasted really, really good.
Awesome. So if that wasn't freaky enough for you, imagine a brick made out of urine. So we covered the story last year. Urine could be turned into bricks, you heard it. The study was conducted by a group of researchers, which included Dr. Dylan Randall of UCT, was the world's first research where human urine was used to make building bricks. So scientists mixed the fresh urine with lime, calcium hydroxide powder, strained the liquid, and then combined it with sand and bacteria, which turned the material into cement-like substance. Yeah. The bricks are sturdy, about as hard as limestone. They are set at room temperature, so their production does not require a coal or wood burning oven. As the bricks are setting, they do exude an unpleasant urine aroma, though the smell subsides in about 48 hours. Our unscience today from we have actually audio sound that we have sourced from the AR sound effects channel on YouTube, as well as copyright free music.
I mean, it is kind of cringeworthy rather to think of making food from feces or pee, building your house out of pee. That's another thing altogether. I mean, I wonder if the house actually smells like pee itself.
Because you think about these things, but what comes into mind generally is yuck. You get grossed out. So,
that is unusual, unlikely, and unscience.
Unusual, unlikely, on science. This is the Science Inside.
You are still tuned to VOW FM, and this is indeed the Science Inside. And as you know, earlier on we were speaking to a space weather practitioner, and her name is Mpho Chisapungo, and she's originally from Chisahulu, a village outside of Thohoyandou in Limpopo. She monitors and analyzes space weather events and provides space weather forecasts, warning the public and private stakeholders of the things that may be happening in space, which may be actually affecting us here on Earth and actually even affecting our GPS signals and all of that. Now we are in that segment of the show where we get up close and personal, and we get to know Mpho a bit more on a personal note. And she is back on air with us. And Mpho,
hello,
welcome back. So my question for you is, I'd like to find out, really, because I want to get to know you a bit better. I want to know what inspired you to get into this profession, specifically, you know, space weather science.
Okay. Maybe I should start a little bit back. When I was still at the University of Venda, doing my Bachelor of Science degree in Math and Physics, actually I didn't know anything about space. and at that time, I was only looking for really opportunities that are out there, because I was really asking myself, after my Bachelor of Science degree, what next? What is this that I'm going to do? So I was just looking for opportunities, and I found this opportunity presented at the department, and then I took the opportunity to actually apply for a winter school to come to Hermanus for the first time in 2006. And that's when I started hearing all about space science and all the different fields in space science. And I got interested because actually it's something which you are curious. It's curiosity which inspired me to enter into the field of space science.
Okay. All right. And what keeps you motivated, even, you know, on the worst day, like, you know, and you're just going through the most on your day at work? What just keeps you going forward? Because now I've learned from you that actually space weather science actually found you. You didn't really go out there searching for a career in space weather science, but I reckon because now you've come to a place and to a level where now you're at the senior level and people look up to you, and now you found yourself leading people, and obviously you love this this profession that you are in. But what keeps you going?
Sometimes it's a bit difficult, but the motivation sometimes comes in, I really ask myself if I really want to be seen as a failure. Because if you want to quit, if it's very difficult, it's like you want to quit sometimes, but you don't want to be seen as a failure. You are already a role model to some of the young women out there, and young black women. So you want to really prove that as women who were previously disadvantaged, it's not that we can't do it. We can do it. So that's some of the things that keep me going, really.
And that leads me into the next question. And that is, what kind of challenges do you face in this particular industry, and how have you managed to pull yourself to the position where you've been able to head such an important division?
The challenge is because in this unit, the special unit that I am in charge of, it's really all about providing the services to the stakeholders or to the clients, and you want to make sure that they are satisfied. And the challenges come in if you are trying to give them the best service, the special service, and there is no we are not like coming into agreement on or understanding or on how we can actually assist them in giving them information so that they can improve their planning in terms of communication. So it's really a challenge, and sometimes you just have to ask for advice from your seniors, and you come up with a solution.
And it's great to hear that you sound so motivated, not only around you and your career, but about other people as well, the people that you're providing services to. And that's always a great thing in a professional with such an amazing skill as well.
And for our final question, Mpo, what is the most fulfilling thing about this work that you do?
I think for me, one of the fulfilling things is that it's satisfying your clients, actually. Usually we get to engage with just the project managers, the people high up. But when you meet with the real users of the information, and then they tell you what your information, how they are using your information, and how it is helping them in their planning, and they are satisfied. I think that is one of the fulfilling things, because you can't just provide information and actually no one is using the information. That's a bit disappointing.
True.
If you can meet with them and they tell you that they are using the information and the information is working for them, I think that's one of the things that is fulfilling.
Wow, thank you so much, Mpo, for your time and speaking to us on the show. It's been really lovely and great having you on The Science Inside. And yeah, I wish you well on your further research studies. And yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
And looking back on what was on this show, it's been an eventful day, hasn't it been?
It has been. I mean, look. Yeah, I mean, the one thing that definitely caught my attention was what we can do with our waste products as human beings, how they can actually just, we can live off ourselves if you really think about it.
Yeah, I don't really think so that much. I mean, like, imagine you eat poo just to poo again and then eat the poo to poo. It doesn't really make sense to me.
I mean, if survival is pushed to the max, I mean, what can we do?
All right, so we had in our news a story about Mars rover checking out the landscape there, and also the Chinese doctor or researcher who had produced his first genetically modified babies, and we found out in our news that he's actually been fired from his post. So that's actually good news, because people need to account for their wrongs. And yes, thanks a lot to our guest who was featured on tonight's show. And today, our team behind the scenes is the production is by Masibulele Lunika, Lebo Madisha, and tech by Kutwano Serame.
And don't forget, you can find our show on a podcast at podcastvids.journalism.co.za/science. And you can also find it on iTunes. And don't forget our social media on Facebook and Twitter as @VowFM.
The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. And that was it for our show this week. Catch you again next week, same time.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on VowFM 88.1. The Science Inside Podcast.